tonight by taking up H. Excuse me?
Starting with adjournment?
Starting with adjournment.
Representative Shetterly. Starting with HJR 7, Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. HJR 7 comes to you from the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee. It is a work product of the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee. Amends Oregon's constitution to create the Oregon Judicial Merit Selection Commission consisting of 13 members. Six members from the Oregon State Bar, four of them would be lawyers, two of them would not. The governor would appoint two members, the chief justice would appoint three members, one being a retired judge. It also allows by the legislature to create judicial districts for the individual judicial districts that we have, excuse me, merit selection commissions for each judicial district, if it so chooses. You have the -2 amendments before you. The main difference with this, I sat down after this with after our last meeting at your request with representatives of the Oregon State Bar and Multnomah Bar Association. The main thing that this does is the original bill says that you could have one commission for circuit judges throughout the whole state or individual commissions for each county if the legislature so chooses. This says it has to be individual commissions for each judicial district. It divides it between those with 10 or fewer circuit court judges, which would require that you have a commission of 11 members. But if you have 10 circuit judges in a district, you would have to have 21 members. The main difference here on the 21 members, you would wind up with more lawyers. Instead of three, I think you would wind up with, 13. I think the rationale for that is, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in the larger counties like Washington County, Lane County, Multnomah County, and Clackamas County, you have numerous people who apply for the bench. Most of the spade work, according to we heard, is done by lawyers. And it gets very taxing to find three lawyers who are willing to do all that work. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Council. Committee?
I know Mr. Olson is here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar.
Thank you, Mr. Schwab.
And as is Mr. Tyner, John Tyner.
Tyner, John Tyner, I'm sorry.
Board of Bar Governors.
Mr.
Do you wish to address the committee, gentlemen?
Okay. Thank you. Bill, I didn't catch. There were a couple of other issues in the bill that we were interested in talking about. One was on line 13 of the bill.
Consists of 13 amendments?
Well, no,
five.
Where we were going to go from 3 to 5.
It says no less than 3, and the Oregon State Bar, after reading that, was fine with the no less than 3. So that could have.
Now we're changing less than fewer, so not
fewer than
3.
Yes.
Meaning they can do more.
They can do more.
And
I think when the president of the bar testified in Harlan, I think when he first read that, he thought it meant that they'd only supply 3. That's no fewer than 3. Okay. So they could submit 5 names.
Okay. And then on the second page, I remember people having concerns about lines 11 and 12.
They're gone.
Which are deleted in the bill. Is that
correct,
right?
Mr. Chairman. Okay. Lines 11 through 33 are deleted. The one other change I forgot to mention, line 7, it says shall serve for a term of 2 years. They requested 3 years, I think because it was a little bit longer term. And as you know, the appointments, particularly the Supreme Court and Court of Appeals, don't come up that often.
Right. That is true. In deleting lines 11 and 12, have we kept any language in the bill that essentially authorizes us to? My recollection was we thought that the reason that lines 11 and 12 on page 2 were in the bill was to essentially say that the Legislative Assembly may adopt additional provisions sort of for the creation of the commission. Did we just determine that that wasn't necessary? Or do we pick it up somewhere else?
I think we probably figured it was not necessary. I mean, I can't remember all the detail of the conversation, but I did sit down not only with representatives of the Oregon State Bar and Multnomah County Bar Association by phone, but Dave Hendricks was in the room when we went through the bill.
That's fine then. Okay. Any further questions about the amendments? It looks like then these amendments have addressed most of the concerns raised by the witnesses who testified, with the exception of Chip Lazenby from the governor's office, but beyond that, I think everybody else's testimony as to their concerns has likely been addressed, and it asked to amendments, at least to some degree. Council.
Chairman of the committee, I do think part of it was addressed, concerns that were raised on page 1, lines 11 and 10 and 11 of the amendment. Judicial Merit Selection Commission may adopt rules governing the commission's procedures.
Okay, okay, there it is. Sure. All right, that's where it's at. Representative Love.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to refresh our memories, Chip Lazenby didn't like this bill at all, right?
That is correct.
It is an understatement. And Multnomah County Bar Association don't like it either because they like, is that right?
No, they supported it.
Oh, they supported it, okay.
Right.
Somehow or another, my notes didn't end up in the file. And John Tyner's here to tell us what Washington County thinks about it.
Well, John, why don't you come up to the, if Representative Law wants to hear you, come up and identify yourself for the record.
Good enough for me, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hardin's testimony before the committee on April 16th indicates that we have agreed to the amendments, and we think that it fairly represents the policy that you and Representative Shevely, last session, were trying to implement in the bill. The governor's office, and we've had a number of conversations with them, obviously aren't thrilled. My guess is that from our perspective, this is the kind of thing. If there's clear legislative wishes for this and that our technical concerns have been met, we're in favor of it.
Can I ask a follow-up question? Maybe Max, you or John, because you both practiced out that neck of the woods. In Washington County, it's kind of the same as in Clackamas County, and it was sort of a bar poll and then a series of interviews. The governor picks the top however many he wants to pick, and then interviews them, and away we go.
The question directed me earlier was, what would the Washington County Bar's view of this be? And I have spoken to them. It would not be supportive of the bill or the big bar's position. They've been struggling over a period of time to figure out a process which meets the various governor's needs. My father was appointed by Governor Attia, and he was, I think, first in the bar poll, and that was before the committee. But subsequent governors have picked from the bar poll as they wish, so to speak, and the committee was set up to kind of give more weight to the wishes of the attorneys in Washington County. That is not, however, the position of the Oregon State Bar.
Thanks, John.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Wilson.
You do such a good job of summarizing these bills for us on occasion. Could I ask you to quickly summarize the problem that this bill addresses?
Well, Representative, let me start with just a brief taking you back in time to last session when the original an original bill was filed, which would have required Senate confirmation of the governor's filling of interim vacancies. Remember that none of this changes judges who choose to, or someone who chooses to run for judge through the elective process, but this would change fundamentally the approach by which interim vacancies are filled. The bill that started last session started out as essentially just requiring Senate confirmation, as is done in most instances with gubernatorial appointments. And a substantial number of the bench in Oregon achieves its status on the bench by gubernatorial appointment. We did some data and ran some statistics. I don't know if council remembers, or maybe that's in the measure summary. Why don't you remind
us? Since 1981, Oregon's governors have appointed approximately 150 individuals to the bench to fill vacancies. Only about a dozen individuals have come directly to the bench via the election route. However, three of them were to the Oregon Supreme Court. Of those judges appointed to the bench, only 18 have had contested elections. Of those 18, only 2 were defeated.
So the point, I guess, Representative Wilson, is that it is the predominant manner in which judges obtain status on the bench in Oregon is through the appointment process.
So what we did last session was we stopped the Senate confirmation bill because generally the feeling on the House committee chaired by Representative Shetterly was that it wasn't the best policy choice. And the Interim Judiciary Committee then took under its advisement this issue and ran a number of hearings and did a fair amount of research. And so in your packet, you've got reports from at least three different independent national organizations who have reviewed this issue and have said in a state like Oregon where you elect judges but interim vacancies are filled by gubernatorial appointment, the best methodology is to have a judicial selection commission which develops a list of candidates that it then gives to the governor, and the governor selects from those candidates. In many respects, you would hear many people say that that's in some ways the system we have now informally. In other words, the bar does bar polls, there is an interview process, recommendations are given to the governor, and the governor may, but is not required to select from that list. And, you know, current and recent current governors have at times gone fairly close to that list and at times have gone off that list. All this would essentially do is take what the American Adjudicature Society, the ABA, and this Task Force for Independence on the Courts model and essentially adopt that model as the methodology for judges at the appellate level in interim vacancies, and then would leave open the option of doing the same thing for trial court judges on a judicial district by judicial district basis, subject frankly to further legislative action if the legislature so chooses to implement that. And originally there was a strong amount of opposition to the concept of this area. Over time, I think as people have gotten more familiar with the proposal and recognized that that maintaining an independence in the judiciary requires, you know, sort of a balance, and the balance comes from a broadly balanced judicial selection commission, which would be less subject to sort of the Byzantine political pressures of even the current process. I think people generally believe that this was a rational step forward. So a lot of people came forward and said, where's the problem? The answer is, I think most of us would agree, that there's very little problem with the current selections to the bench. But it doesn't mean that you can't make a system better. And I think most of us that worked on this on a more detailed level were convinced that this was a better solution. Representative Shetterly.
Yeah, I have always described this resolution as institutionalizing the best practices. I think this is largely followed to the governor's credit and to the credit of the governors preceding this one. But we do have examples across the fence and in neighboring yards, other states, where this unfettered power to appoint has been abused to political ends by governors of both parties and of different political persuasions. And the point of this, I think, is to broaden the selection process so that it includes more than just a governor and includes actually public members as well to make the initial evaluation of candidates so that there's some real political public buy-in to this process. And I think this will help ensure the independence of the judiciary from political influence.
Representative Backlund and then Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that previous meeting, I think Chip Lazenby indicated that he preferred that this be made into a law and not a constitutional amendment. Comment on that?
Representative Backlund, when these concepts were originally being discussed, it's pretty clear that currently the most we could do is set something up that would be recommending but not mandatory that the governor select from the list. So in order to make it a mandatory selection off the list process, it requires a constitutional referral. There's no other way around that. You know, that's a policy choice, but frankly, for the system to really function the way it's designed, and as the reports in all three of these various national organizations that have looked at this suggest, that's the methodology that's most suggested. That's how you avoid the tamper impact of the governor sort of not being obligated to move forward with the list that's being put forward. Further question?
Could I make a comment?
Yes, Representative Wong.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been sitting here pondering, you know, trying to decide how to vote on this, and I've struggled with it because the Ed Harden arguments, I mean, it sounded great and convinced me, and then I listened to what Chip had to say, and that convinced me too, and so I've been struggling back and forth with it, and so finally I started thinking about judges I have known. different styles of judges, different skills in resolving the problems of the people and meeting out justice. And I started thinking about that and tried to superimpose it over what a blue ribbon committee would pick. And the truth of the matter is this, in my opinion. I'm the most learned and erudite and highly respected and esteemed people in their profession. I mean, you have to have a certain baseline knowledge and a certain skill level, that's true. But you also have to have huge people skills and a big heart and a sense of compassion and a sense of fairness and a creative soul. You have to be pretty well-balanced individual to be a good judge. Because you're dealing with citizens where the rubber hits the road. And I think it is more likely that one individual looking at a skill set of many candidates is going to be able to come up with the best fit, the best person for the community that they're trying to fit something into. I seriously don't have that level of confidence when you're looking at a blue ribbon panel of some of the most erudite lawyers and the best and most distinguished citizens and so forth coming up and making an elephant by committee, making a judge by committee. I think that they're less likely to select, to look at a community and say, well, this is a county that's full of farmers and they need somebody who can relate to them on their own level and understand and have, you know, certain background. I don't think that they can tailor the job to the individual. I don't think you can do that by committee. I therefore am not going to vote in favor of this. Finally, I've decided, and I don't know if I've convinced you or not, but just think about the judges that you have known and ask yourself, the best among them, the fairest and the most judge-like among them, would that individual have been selected by a committee? Off of the Martindale Hubble? I doubt it.
Thank you, Representative Wolf. Further comment? Representative Ringo.
Well, I missed the first of this. You know, the thing that I find difficult is first deciding whether the system is broken. You know, are we fixing something that's not broken? And I know that Representative Shetterly has commented that still, there's always room for improvement, and maybe we should strive to improve. And I think where I come down on this is I don't think that the system is broken, but on the other hand, there is a public perception out there that things are less than fair. And if a merit selection commission would help the public have greater confidence, then I think it's probably a worthwhile thing. And because of that, I'm going to vote for this.
Thank you, Representative Ringo. Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm opposed to this. It's a system that isn't broke. It doesn't need fixed. If we make it better, we can do so in other ways besides putting this in the Constitution. So I appreciate what everyone said today and the treatises that are in this file, but I'm not there.
Further discussion. I just point out that one of the things that I think this brings to the table is the involvement of the public in the process. Currently, under the current system, with the exception of a few changes that have been made during the period of time that this has been under discussion at some of the local bar level, there has not been active public participation by non-lawyers or people not associated with the bench or bar in the selection process. You know, one of the things that I think is important here is that two members would be appointed They would neither be judges nor members of the Oregon State Bar, which means some public participation in the process. This would also add some legislative participation in the process, which I don't think is inappropriate.
I think is appropriate?
No, I think is appropriate. I do not think it's inappropriate to have a minority representation of a couple of legislators in this discussion. In the last 4 years, we've seen a couple of measures that have been filed but not qualified for the ballot, which would have substantially changed the entire manner in which we do the judiciary in this state. They've been harmful measures and ones that I was strongly opposed to. What I believe HJR 7, with the modifications that we've adopted here today, or we will if we adopt the Dash 2 amendments, would do, would send a message that we are not above considering new alternatives to how judges get appointed, that we're willing to open the process up and include some public involvement. And I think that's a positive step forward, and I think it might be sufficient demonstrate a willingness to move forward. So as Representative Ringel pointed out, while I have no problem with the appointees and as the process is run, I do believe that that there are a number of people who feel that it is a very closed system, and I think this is the first step in making this an open system in a way that I think is more responsive to the public's concern about the future and direction of both the bench and the bar. Any further comments? Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, there's a treatise in here from Kevin Mannix, and I remember all last session, you know, him screaming about judicial adventurism, didn't like the rulings. And I think you're seeing that across the country, that when people don't like the rulings, they want to change the process. The president is changing his process. He's not going to listen to the American Bar Association anymore because he thinks they're too liberal. So I think it's people who are concerned about wanting this to be a political process, and that's why this change is being made.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would dovetail on those comments that if the process, the best practices process that involved the ABA and its broad participation in vetting federal candidates were part of the federal constitution, the president couldn't just dismiss that process. I think that's the whole point about this, about institutionalizing the best practices, so that some governor can't just say, well, I don't care what you say, I've got this person who I promised I'm going to make a judge, and I'm going to make him a judge, and he's going to do what I say he's going to do. This process, well, that's what Gray Davis said when he said that he appoints judges, he expects them to rule the way that he's said on the campaign trail that his administration is going to be run. He considers them to be effectively agency administrators to carry out his policies. This kind of commission process will insulate the judiciary from that, and a governor will not just be able to dismiss that process if it happens to be inconvenient for him or her. If we do what we are proposing to do in this HJR, and we install it in the Constitution.
Okay. Representative Ringo.
I'm sorry about that. Ed Harnden had one suggestion, and I'm just looking at the HJR 7. I think he wanted to increase the number of people on the list that would be forwarded.
Representative, you missed that brief discussion.
Okay.
They met over the Dash 2 amendments, and while the Dash 2 amendments doesn't do that, I think what they found out was, as the bar read that more closely, it says not less than, it would change it to not fewer than, which would allow for additional more than three to be submitted, and they were satisfied with that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the discussion. You know, this is not an easy choice because I hear complaints about the judiciary all the time, although many of them are somewhat veiled and nondescriptive. But you know, one thing that I do appreciate about not changing the law is the fact that we know where the buck stops. You know, if the governor is going to be involved in the selection process and they are his choices ultimately, I like that. On the other hand, with the shadowy complaints that I get about the judiciary, the citizen involvement portion seems to be good. I guess I'm just thinking out loud. I will support this today to get it out of committee. and may wind up likely supporting it on the floor as well. But I want you to know, I appreciate the discussion, because this is not a push-pull, click-click situation. You know, this is hard stuff, and so I appreciate the dialogue. It's been instructive.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Any other comments by committee members? Okay. With that, the chair would move the adoption of the dash two amendments to HJR 7. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? The amendments have been adopted.
Chair would move
HJR 7 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Shannon, you call the roll. Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Dean Felder? Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Cheverly?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Vicki Walker?
No.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lowe?
No.
Chair Williams?
Aye. HGR 7 will move to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended. Representative Cheverly, would you join me as a co-chair on this? Thank you, Council. Enjoy your run. We're now going to open a work session, again moving from the bottom forward, on House Bill 3931. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3931 is part of the continuing work to conform Oregon law to ballot measure 3, the constitutional change regarding civil forfeitures. The subject of House Bill 3931 is forfeiture of archaeological artifacts. There was a work group convened that was had representatives of various tribes, the Governor's Commission on Indian Affairs, and the Department of Justice. What we needed to do in this to make this bill work was to separate it into several distinct phases. The first is Section 2, which deals with objects that have been termed as contraband. Those are things that really no one is entitled to own. They're archaeological artifacts, funerary objects, human remains, sacred objects, and objects of cultural patrimony. Those are objects that are summarily returned to the tribe unless there is a person who files a claim alleging that they have the lawful right of possession, and the only ones of these would be archaeological objects. The Section 3, the prior law created a cause of forfeiture, civil forfeiture that could be brought either by the Indian tribe or by the state. Section 3 retains the ability of the tribe to pursue a civil forfeiture. So the tribe as a sovereign nation is not under the strictures of our constitutional requirements, so they have retained the same provisions that they previously had, which means that they are not required to pursue meet the requirement of a criminal conviction. Section 4 is the existing provision that is now governed, that proceeding by the state, governed by ORS Chapter 475A, which you may recall we amended to make consistent with the with the civil forfeiture provisions in the Constitution. There also have been some amendments submitted that I think Representative Ackerman will suggest to the committee that came up during the presentation by Karen Quigley of the Indian Commission.
Thank you, Council. Representative Ackerman.
I'm sort of handicapped. I didn't bring my file here, but I talked with Council within the last hour, so if I have some memory retention, maybe I can help.
If you do it this time of the day, you're probably
one of the only ones on the committee.
Right. I think there's a couple of key things here. One is that the possession of these archaeological artifacts are prohibited by law, and I think mostly give rise to a misdemeanor status by the possessor. As counsel said, and as is correct, this makes these items not instrumentalities of a crime, like a weapon, but contraband for which there has never been any ownership rights recognized. Contraband, like perhaps drugs, would be subject to forfeiture with or without the conviction of the person who perpetrated the underlying offense. So to some extent, it's a little bit, you can't quite mesh it into measure three, because measure three, remember, required the conviction and I think proof by clear and convincing evidence that the instrumentality seized was used in the crime itself. Here we're dealing with counterband, so it's a little bit of a different, it's an entirely different situation in my mind. As we go through the process here, there is a claims procedure, however, and the Indian tribes could either file a claim in the forfeiture proceeding, which is a separate proceeding from the criminal proceeding, or they can initiate the claim themselves, and then there's a process for identifying which tribe should have disposition over the items. And I believe, with the exception of archaeological artifacts like arrowheads, the rest of the items, such as human remains and what have you, then would be a process where they go back to the appropriate Indian tribe for appropriate disposition in accordance with their laws and culture. That's without the bill.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. And it's the Dash One Amendment that you have in front of us.
I do.
That essentially would allow that returning of the
contraband to the
No, is that wrong?
No.
I'm wrong? Okay. I'm sorry. Council, why don't you take us through then the Dash One Amendment?
Okay. Thank you. The Dash One Amendments modify the disposition if the state is the entity that brings the cause of action for the forfeiture. If the Indian tribe brings the action themselves, they retain any property or money that is forfeited. If the state brings it, because we've chosen to make the procedure under ORS Chapter 475 applicable, that would go into the funds of the county or the state, and for specific uses that the state or the county would designate. This amendment would apply to those funds where the cause of action is brought by the county or the state, and require that any forfeited property or proceeds be paid over to the Commission on Indian Services after deducting the allowable costs of the forfeiting agency. The commission then would deliver the property or proceeds to the appropriate Indian tribe as designated by the commission. If there is no appropriate tribe, if they can't ascertain any appropriate tribe, then the commission would receive the proceeds to use for Indian historic preservation.
Thank you. Now, maybe I misunderstood. Other than the Dash Ones, are there other amendments that are necessary?
No other amendments have been proposed.
Okay.
Chair Williams.
Good. Thank you. Well, we're in work session.
Chair, I'll move the Dash One amendments.
Representative Ackerman moves the Dash One amendments to House Bill 3931. Is there any further discussion on the amendments? Is there any objection?
Excuse me, Chair Williams, did you say 31? I think it's 39.
31. No, I thought I said 39-31.
Oh, I'm sorry, maybe I didn't hear you correctly.
Yeah, okay. 39-31.
We're getting tired,
adopted.
I think.
Representative Ackerman?
Yes, I'll move House Bill 39-31 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves House Bill 39-31 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Shannon.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder?
Aye.
Representative Ringo? Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker.
Aye.
Representative Vicki Walker.
Excuse.
Representative Wilson. Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Lo.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 3931 is amended, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Ackerman, could you carry it on the floor?
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Marilyn. Have a pleasant evening. Now we'll go back up to the top, and we'll start with a work session on House Bill 2687. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2687 comes to you from the Oregon Advocacy Center. In the subcommittee this morning, we adopted the Dash 3 amendments, which have substantially changed the bill, and now basically just apply Title II of the American with Disabilities Act of 1990 to every Oregon public body. Representative Shetterly to carry.
Representative Shetterly.
Whoops. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The United States Supreme Court held that federal laws relating to discrimination against persons with disabilities under the Americans with Disabilities Act do not apply to states. This bill is Oregon's response to that by nevertheless acknowledging its responsibility to conduct itself and, in fact, apply this to all public bodies within the state to the same standard as the federal law. We amended it in the subcommittee with respect to the definition of public body. You'll see the Dash 3 amendments which we adopted. Interestingly, in the statutes that created the Oregon State Bar and Oregon Health Sciences University, they say that after the effective date of those statutes, any law that is of general applicability to public bodies does not apply to the bar or to OHSU unless the law specifically names the bar or OHSU. And so the Dash 3 amendments make it clear that when we say that this is applicable to public bodies throughout the state, we are not creating an exception to the bar or OHSU. It's interesting to see them named like that, but that's the only way to make this statute applicable to them. So with that, I would move House Bill 2687 as amended in the subcommittee to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly has moved House Bill 2687 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there committee discussion? Representative Ackerman.
Yes. In your hearings or other deliberations, was there any notion brought forth that there should be an exception based upon reasonable accommodation or undue hardship upon the public entity in the determination of liability, much like there is in the disability section under for disabilities in the employment context?
I don't think there was discussion. I think the intent and I believe effect of this by incorporating the liability under Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act would be to also incorporate the same exceptions to liability that are in that act, where the public bodies are this is on line 16 and 17, subject to action under Title II of the ADA. And, of course, the ADA includes within it its own, whatever those exceptions are. I guess this is intended to be coextant. I think that's the word with the liability that I believe the state assumed that it had until the Supreme Court said that it did not under Title II of the ADA.
And, in fact, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand the process by which this bill moved through the subcommittee, originally, the bill could have been interpreted to actually broaden the state's liability, and the committee made an effort to bring the liability on this bill back in tow specifically with what they had been previously required to do under Title II.
Could you give me that cite again? Are you citing for the bill?
The Dash 3 amendments,
okay,
lines 16 and 17.
Okay. Yes, Representative Ringo.
I
I'm satisfied that this does exactly that. The ADA requires reasonable accommodation, and this just proves that in exactly.
I think my question's been answered. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman. Just again, committee, to give anyone comfort who didn't sit in on those meetings, there was some strong, at first, I believe, some strong opposition to the original version of the bill because it seemed to open doors that people weren't comfortable with. By the time this version of the amendment got drafted, I believe everybody had essentially gotten on board. Isn't that right?
That's right.
Correct.
Okay. No. Good. Thanks,
Madam
Chairman. No, that's...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yes, I think that basically as amended, this bill returns us to the status quo prior to the declaration of the United States Supreme Court that states are not, in fact, liable under Title II of the ADA. We always thought we were, and I think that's the way the state has conducted its business in since the ADA was adopted.
Okay, thank you. We could get Mr. Olson up here and ask him if he's comfortable about having the bar listed on this. I was sort of only jesting. You're there, Bob. Are you here to speak to this at all?
Mr. Chair, this is a difficult one to say very much on. Representative Shetterly did, I guess the impression said, unless we strongly objected, he would suggest that we be included. We have not objected. Our leaders could not find any real strong basis for objecting for this since we already have the federal law and have no problems with that. So,
yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
It looks like we're out to get the bar on OHSU the way you look at this, but truly the whole point of this by naming them is simply to say that this is going to apply to them as it does every other public body in the state, and I think that's fair.
And as a public corporation, they're just included in this, and that's what you have to do to catch them, right?
Right.
Okay.
I would like to comment.
Yes, Representative Walker.
Thank you. We had questions as to whether SAFE needed to be specifically named, and they did not. And according to how I think Andrea Chartel could probably explain that more because she handled it, but they already have provisions that include them because they are not specifically barred as the other two were.
Okay, thank you. Representative Shadowley again.
Just for clarification, there are statutes that exempt SAFE from certain laws relating to public entities, but those laws relate to finance and I think maybe some insurance regulation, but they do not exempt, they're not the broad exemption from all public body laws that the bar and OHSU have in their enabling legislation.
Well, I know this has been a little bit more lengthy of a discussion, but considering that this is a fairly important thing that we're doing here by putting the state back under the auspices of the ADA, I think it's important to have and develop the record that we're doing that and only that, and we're not intending to go beyond that, both with the exception language to the ADA as well as this new language that is being adopted. So I appreciate everyone's comments. With that, Representative Shetterly has moved this bill as amended. Is there any further discussion on his motion? Hearing none, Shannon, if you'll call the roll. Aye.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Representative Ringel?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative
Dinkfelder? Excused.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lowe?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2687, as amended, moves to the full committee. To the floor. Any takers on this? Representative Shirley, do you want it, or do you want it?
That's
Charlie,
fine.
Do you want it?
Fine. You got it?
Is that okay?
Sure.
All right.
I was kind of holding off with Molder.
Moldling?
You can have it, too.
All right. Representative Ringo will carry the ADA bill. We're now going to open a hearing on House Bill, or work session, I'm sorry, on House Bill 3398. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3398 comes to you from Representative Williams, and it's at the request of the Oregon School Boards Association. It sets a 2-year time limit for requesting a special education due process hearing. We also have a -1 amendment, which I believe were talked about in concept, but I'm not sure if we actually adopted them or not. I think that they were just talked about, that add an emergency clause. And the carrier was Representative Backlund.
Representative Backlund. You just can't get away from those education bills.
Well, that's the way it should be. No, I think I want to thank Andrea for her comments, and I don't know that I have anything in particular to add. I think it's something that I would recommend, and so I guess I will leave it with that.
Representative Shirley.
There was discussion in the subcommittee about the effective date. If you look at Section 3 in the bill, it says it applies to acts or omissions that give rise to the right to request a hearing occurring on or after the effective date of the act. I had asked whether, if we thought this was good policy, we ought to apply the two-year limit to claims that may have already given rise to an action. And Jim Green is here from the OSBA. And it's my understanding they've talked to the proponents, to the other parties interested in this, and the Dash 1 amendment seemed to be what everyone was able to agree on and satisfy the concerns out there. So claims that are out there current will still have 6 years to file. The emergency clause will make this effective to acts which give rise to claims after the date the governor signs this into law.
Okay.
So I can live with that if they can. I don't think there's not a large number of cases out there anyway.
But essentially it means that instead of waiting until January 1 of 2002, it would simply mean that once the governor signed it, claims that arise after that date would be subject to the 2-year statute of limitation. But we're not reaching back and capturing claims that have occurred currently where people would be subject to the 6-year statute of limitation.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Yeah, that seems to sum up the bill very nicely. Historically, I have notes here. Historically, there was a 2-year statute of limitations, but a judge recently said 6 years, and this simply takes it back to 2 years. At least that's the way I interpret it. So.
Okay. Well,
Chair.
Representative Shirley.
Move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3398.
Representative Shirley has moved the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3398. Is there any discussion on the amendment involving the emergency clause? Is there any objection? Okay, the bill is amended.
Sure.
Representative Shirley.
House Bill 3398 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shirley moves House Bill 3398 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this motion? Shannon, if you'll call the roll.
Representative Backlund.
Aye.
Representative
Backlund. Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Ringo.
Aye.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Novick.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3398. Moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended. And Representative Backlund, will you carry on the floor? Thank you. And our last bill for the evening is House Bill 3533, that lien mold or mold lien. Council.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. This bill comes to us from Representative Westland at the request of the American Plastics Council. And we just heard about it for the very first time this morning and passed it out this morning. No amendments that I'm aware of, and I don't think we've gotten anything from fiscal, but I can't imagine that there is any fiscal impact. Chair Walker, Representative Walker to carry.
Thank you, Andrew. This morning, the testimony showed that what happens is these companies that make plastic components have the plastic molds that they create, which can be very expensive. They testify to be $50,000 to $200,000 sometimes for these molds, and they make things like the plastic cases that go on inkjets. So the components that they make are not a finished product in and of themselves. They are components to other products, even though the little product that it may mold may be just worth a few cents in itself. And what happens is if they do not get paid, then they're left with no opportunity to attach a lien to the mold itself. And this provides the opportunity for them to attach this and sell it if it's not paid in 60 days.
Thank you, Representative Walker. I can only imagine that it was a scintillating hearing.
It was, absolutely. I heard all about injection molding and extruder molding and stuff like that. It was very interesting.
I am so sorry, Mr. Chairman. May I say something?
Yes.
That I missed this, because there is a plastics mold maker in my district who is a major employer, the Bios Company. And they have made such famous products as a plastic golf cart in the shape of a mouse for none other than Bill Gates. And yes, you're right, these are horrendously expensive molds.
I assume that means a computer mouse as opposed to the one with the ears.
A computer mouse golf cart.
Okay.
It was
all
really
right.
Cute.
Just checking.
Their shining moment.
Thank you. Okay, well, we're in work session. Representative Walker, do you have a motion?
Yes, I do. Mr. Chair, I move that the House Bill 3533 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cheryl Walker moves House Bill 3533 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion on the motion?
And may I suggest that perhaps we could get Mr. Gates' mouse to come here for a demonstration that day?
Oh, that would be fascinating.
Well, I have just drawn it. So.
Representative Cheryl.
Just to say, this bill is so boring, I can't even think of a pun.
I think we're all just very tired. Shannon, call the roll.
It was.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder?
Aye.
Representative Ringel?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
If I can quote Kerry, I guess I can say aye.
Oh, Kerry.
Vice Chair Walsh?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 3533 moves forward with the due pass recommendation. Let me just say, I'm only disappointed that this couldn't have been Representative Dingfelder's first bill to carry on the floor. And I do want to take this brief moment to congratulate her on her expert job. The only thing that the House fails to do sometimes is recognize when too much of a good thing
is enough.
I agree.
I
couldn't agree more.
too bad we couldn't figure that out.
That's why I voted for the bill the first time.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Representative Krieger.
Chair Williams?
Yes, Representative Walker.
I know perhaps this isn't appropriate, but I would like to suggest that perhaps if you ever consider one for the consent calendar, maybe the mold moldy bill would be one that would be appropriate.
Moldy bill.
Well, we can do that.
Russ is saying, yeah.
We can do that. We typically don't do that out of
this
committee.
I know we typically
don't. For this bill, I will make the exception.
Okay.
Representative Cheryl Walker has moved that we add House Bill 3533 to the consent agenda of the House on its way to the floor. Is there any objection to that?
If anybody does object, guess what?
Hearing no objection, then we will add this bill to the consent calendar. And with that, we are adjourned for the evening. Thank you.
I think that's all. It's real well.